once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour, or second episode, as the case may be, of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if today is Saturday, December 26th, where you are, well, actually, if you're listening on the internet, it could be Sunday the 27th.
It is possible.
Right, but if it's either...
We have had people listen from across the dateline.
Right, if it's either Saturday, December 26th, or Sunday, December 27th, and you're hearing this on your radio or on the internet live as opposed to a podcast, then you're welcome to give us a call at 773-1400 or...
1-866-597-1400. If you are listening to a podcast, you can also call us, but we won't answer.
Well, that's true. But we might answer. I mean, you never can tell about these things. It could be that if you called the other number,
if they were
947-1111.
Maybe they were listening on a Saturday morning. It was just
right.
The wrong Saturday morning.
It could be, but something like that might happen. But we do have a caller on 773-1400. And caller, I think you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call. I've read in the Wall Street Journal that, I guess, January 1, oil companies have to have new accounting rules for determining how much untapped reserves they have. Are you guys aware of that? Can you explain it a little bit more? I'll hang up and listen. Thank
okay.
You.
I'm aware of it. It's not earth-shaking, really. The point is that the old accounting rules defined oil reserves, in other words, known exploitable reserves, differently than they account for them today. Because there are rocks under there that now we know people can get oil out of that they couldn't get oil out of before. So what you're going to see, nobody will know until after. Actually, you won't know January 1st. You'll know later on in the year when they start reporting their known reserves as an asset. You will see the numbers go up.
Yes. This is in no way a simple question. The securities... Exchange and Commission, they're setting a rule. It's a rule 410.
which is the size of a really small shotgun.
Right. It is also the size of a very large book.
Uh-huh.
So a small shotgun or a large book. It basically talks about a more refined, you see what I did with the word refined?
Ooh, I think that was cool.
Way of accounting for reserves. And it also...
Boy, that's esoteric, though.
Yeah, it also... I mean, there's some good things that come out of it.
It's pretty volatile.
It's going to be more expensive for the oil companies, but you'll get a better picture, and so will they, of what the expense is in exploiting those reserves. If you're talking about fracking, for instance, you have this huge reserve number, but it's based on basically dissolving rock. It's not a simple process, which is why the rest of the world is not very good at it yet. You've got to take different forms of acid and bleach and blow it at high pressure into rock to get the oil out of it. The SEC is saying in order to really have a capability of understanding what a well should be valued at, we need to know what the reserves it's sitting on top of are. And they were... pretty good at accounting for them now. It's not going to be that big a change. It's going to be more exact in how they do it. Right now, there's not a simple system that you can apply across the board to everywhere, and now there will be, starting January 1.
Well, that's not as important, actually, as a much simpler method of measuring oil quantities.
Right.
How much oil is it Cushing? Cushing, Oklahoma.
That's the big reserve tanks.
It was a slight drop at Cushing, and that's why the prices went from 35-something to 38-something. Another thing that somebody said, if you wanted a contrarian indicator, I was reading this morning, it certainly makes sense. The OPEC, based in Saudi Arabia, officially has taken the position that you will not see a recovery in oil prices to above $100 a barrel until about 2040.
Wow.
And that's taking into account likely dollar inflation between now and then. Which is, somebody said if you wanted a contrarian indicator, that would be a good contrarian indicator. The problem with being a contrarian is that you can be waiting a long time for something to happen.
Right.
I actually, the other thing they said is...
It depends on what you're being a contrarian to. If you're being a contrarian to the dump truck traveling at 80 miles an hour towards you,
you
probably shouldn't say, well, I believe that he'll turn around and go the other direction.
That has to do with momentum and time again.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Anyway.
We're talking about that on the way to the program this
morning. Yes, we were talking about the irreversibility of time.
And momentum.
So the point that I think is significant in all of this is that we probably should not expect to see oil prices a lot higher anytime in the near future. We probably are not done with the decline in energy prices. But we placed into effect in our society, and it was kind of cemented in Paris, that we are going to reduce the use of fossil fuels across the planet. And I realize there's some people, and particularly on the conservative side of things politically, who think this is all just silliness. But it's a reality, whether you think it's politically silly or not, it's a reality. And the reality is that one of the larger oil users in the world, China, has concluded that they would like to continue to be able to breathe.
Their demand has dropped a little bit.
And as a result, the authorities in China have concluded that it probably would be a good idea to convert to something that doesn't use fuel and thereby put stuff in the air you can't breathe. Because apparently one of the things that's going on in China right now, and I'm quite serious about this, is their reduced economic growth rate, and nobody knows exactly what it is. It's not negative. It's not like they're shrinking. But their reduced economic growth rate is at least partially attributable to the fact that where their economic growth historically has occurred is downwind of where they generate power, and apparently their use of fossil fuels extensively has decreased economic growth in the country measurably. And being very practical people in China, they have concluded that it is probably in their best interest to stop using so much fossil fuel. And
it's kind of the same thing we came to the conclusion of here. I mean, the fact that we had acid rain falling and rivers lit on fire and that sort of thing. We said, well, I think we should probably do little changes here because I don't like breathing black stuff.
And as a result, the oil consumption per dollar of GDP has been dropping and probably will continue to drop. With relatively mature, as they're called, growth in GDP across the world. And by the way, the United States is currently, I just looked at the numbers on that, one of the fastest growing economies on the planet. It's certainly one of the fastest growing large economies on the planet. Now, that sounds absolutely amazing to most Americans, but it's true. The Economist publishes this on a regular basis, and it's kind of fascinating to me to note that the GDP of the United States, growing at 2.1%, is growing faster than Japan, the same speed as Great Britain, twice as fast as Canada. You start down the list, Austria 1%, Belgium 1.3%. You start down the list, Germany. Germany's GDP growth year over year right now, 1.7%. Ours is 2.1. If you really wanted a place, so it really is a good sign, the rate of growth we're seeing in the United States. It's 2.5% in the United States.
A relatively major shift in the past year and a half or so in currency rates. You mentioned Canada there. And American dollars are buying a lot more overseas, but not just overseas. It was just a year and a half ago that the Canadian dollar was at par with the United States dollar. So $1 for $1. We commented about it on the air. We actually said, whoa, there was a time when a Canadian dollar was worth more than an American dollar.
Mm-hmm.
It's now at about $1.40 Canadians to buy $1 American, or 72 cents to buy a Canadian dollar.
Mm.
And
which means it's a good time to take a vacation in Canada.
Right. It's a great time to take a vacation in Canada. It's a great time to buy things from Canada.
Oh, wait a minute. Weather-wise, it might not be a great time.
Yeah, well, let's head up right in the middle of January. And
to Banff and go skiing.
Right. It should be, as long as you have a space heater in your, as in like the space suit, NASA version space heater, you should be fine.
Right. Exactly. But this is one of those things that at the end of the year, there's a lot of bad news. Bad news sells papers. Fires
and
in
electronic
the West Coast.
Versions of papers, yes.
Yeah, and I want you to think about something just a moment. Where did that house trailer burn? I think it was in California.
Somewhere. It's made national news.
And I want
the house trailer burned.
Think about just think a moment that on the last newscast, it was just before this hour of the program, a house trailer burning in California made national news.
That means there's not a lot of bad news out there, or they'd be giving it to you. They like bad news.
Right,
the media thrives on it. It's what causes you to want to buy more or listen intently, is if there's bad news happening.
There's a flood in Georgia.
Yes.
And Alabama. And it may snow in the panhandle a lot.
Right.
The reason I bring this up is the news media sells bad news, because bad news sells papers.
It's what we like to pay for. We're not. Right. George Will said it so well. No one reports on news, on airplanes that land safely.
So this is the reality. For 2015, so far, the United States gross domestic product, I'm sorry, let's make that as of October, that's the fiscal year, has grew 2.4%. The estimate, which, by the way, this comes out of a compilation of the world institutions and everything else, the estimate for next year is 2.5. And these, by the way, tend to come in pretty close to right. So you think, okay, that really, we talk about how terrible that is. But then you look around the rest of the world, and Germany, the super healthy economy of Germany that's loaning money to everybody and complaining about whatever they want to complain about, their 2015, for the same time period, their growth rate, their GDP growth rate is 1.6%. By the way, there's another little piece of good news out there. The three countries that are at least nominally part of Europe that have the highest GDP rate, would you make a guess as to what they are? For 2015.
Do you mean the currency block? Or
No, I'm not the currency block. Just nominally, not the United States and not Asia and not Africa.
Part of Europe as a continent, or part of the European Union?
That are generally considered to be part of Europe.
I would say Switzerland, Great Britain, and Hungary.
No.
What?
Ireland.
Okay.
Greece and Iceland.
Three that just got the clock cleaned during the Great Recession.
And this there's a
lot of recovery that could happen there.
Because they were so low, it's relatively easy for them to grow off of a very low point. But this is the point I want to make. Over the last several years, the stock markets in the United States have tanked on the threat of Greece collapsing and going completely under.
And they're having a recovery.
And Iceland going under, and Ireland going under. And these are the places where the fastest economic growth is going on right now. Now, what else happened this month that was a negation of bad news? It was not reported on.
Besides Christmas? Christmas is kind of good news.
But it's not a negation of bad news. Remember the fears of bankruptcy in Puerto Rico?
Yes.
The major debt holder, the debt issuer in Puerto Rico, that was under the greatest threat of literally shutting down, going bankrupt, and causing an economic collapse.
Some money was provided.
Was the public utility of, I don't remember exactly what it's called, but it's the state-owned public, or it's not really a state, the Commonwealth-owned Public Utilities Corporation of Puerto Rico, whatever it's called, that pumps electricity to the whole island because they were about to default. And if they defaulted, they couldn't buy oil. And if they couldn't buy oil, they couldn't generate electricity. And the whole island would shut down. And people would starve and there would be a crisis. With no major, there was a little tidbit in there in the Omnibus Budget Act to kind of give them a little bit of push
small
in the right
amount
direction.
Of money, comparatively. I mean, it's more than I have in my bank account, but small comparatively.
Somebody was working, and I don't know, I was unable to find out who negotiated this, what powerful entity negotiated this. It wasn't the Puerto Ricans, because nobody gives them a great deal of credit. It certainly wasn't the junk bond funds that have, the hedge funds that have bought up all this debt thinking that the United States government is going to jump in and rescue them.
It's two insurance companies.
Two insurance companies.
Bond insurers stepped
really?
In. Two major bond insurance companies have stepped in and are, the quotes around, making progress towards an effort of paying this.
But the whole point is progress is being made just as it was in Greece and just as it was in Ireland and just as it was in Iceland. And it's being done quietly behind the scenes. I would almost bet money here, man. If I were a betting person, and I'm not, I would be willing to bet that some government entity is right smack dab in the middle of that too. Because here's the point: a bailout of Ireland in any form would enrich some hedge fund owners.
Drastically, yes, hugely, because they stepped in as vultures, pure vultures.
And they bought up these bonds at a huge discount.
And now are insisting that they get paid back in full.
Right, and what's happening is some entity, now the insurance companies are stepping in, but they're obligated to pay if these bonds go under.
Now, while I say...
But somebody with a big stick is also sitting in the room very quietly saying to the hedge funds, you guys push this too far, we'll just cut you off. And I don't know how they're going to do that, but nobody short of the United States government has the power to do that.
In Ireland and in Iceland, they basically said to the hedge funds, you can have your money, but you have to leave it in the bank here
right.
in Iceland
well,
or sovereign, here in Ireland.
They're sovereign nations. They can do things
right.
like
they
that.
Can say, you can't take it away. We'll give you the money, but you can't use it anywhere but here.
But Greece...
Without a 30% tax.
The Greeks... were kind of at the mercy of whoever, and ultimately, behind the scenes, somebody from the European Union stepped in.
Probably with a German accent, but maybe an Italian accent.
Right, and also told the hedge fund owners, I'm sorry, you're not going to make a massive killing on this, you're going to take a haircut. You're going to lose money on the deal.
Yeah, and Puerto Rico is not in there's a lot of hedge funds there. The utility issue is not a hedge fund issue. This is an issue where... they issued bonds thinking they need the money and interest rates are going to stay down forever. And, of course, everyone in Puerto Rico is going to stay in Puerto Rico. It's very similar to what happened in Detroit where they were issuing bonds and they said, well, it's pure safe bonds because we have the power to tax our municipality. And that's never going to go away, except that Detroit's now got one-tenth the people that it used to have. And Puerto Rico... it's now getting into really, really terrifying realm of highly educated people leaving Puerto Rico in droves. And those are the high earners. Those are the ones that get the highest tax bill. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that actually pay for the running of government. And when they leave, it leaves the people that get paid for the running of government.
Right.
That's not a good thing.
And in many ways, Puerto Rico is our Greece. And we are, and it is being dealt with very much the same way Greece was.
Who's our Turkey? Because Turkey and Greece, this is Thanksgiving and Christmas time. And
I could actually get in there.
Who's the cranberry sauce?
And make a comment about it. but it wouldn't go over real well politically. Anyway, so the point I wanted to make is we have these tremendous fears that the system isn't working or isn't going to work. Whatever the system is, our socioeconomic system, and that something is going to collapse and that it's going to be a terrible disaster. And if you back up and look at it, you analyze, we kept talking about the size of Greece being such a tiny little nit of that of the European Union. And of course, it could set a precedent. But so the point is, Greece did not collapse.
Well, it depends on your definition of the word collapse.
Well, they didn't.
I would say it was a collapse, but not a total collapse.
It was. They definitely had a crisis. They definitely had a shrinkage in their economy. They're definitely having a lot of people flooding out of their country. Of course, they're also having a lot of people flooding into their country, which the European Union is paying them for right now, which is a tremendous help to
their
economy.
There are a lot of people going to Greece on vacation right now.
From Syria.
From Syria, yeah.
Yes.
Saying this is your tourism is suffering because of your economic problems, so we're going to come with no money.
Right. So, but the European Union is pumping money into Greece to pay for them to keep the immigrants.
Don't send them up to us. Just you keep them right there for a while.
So there's a lot of moving parts in the economy, in the world economy, and in the economies of developed nations. And fundamentally, the European Union is not broken. The system isn't broken. It is not as healthy as ours, but it's not broken.
And that's
the Chinese system is not broken, and the American system is healthy.
Yeah, when we look back at what we were talking about 2 years ago, and the question was, will the European Union stick around or will they be able to make it? We gave it a 50-50, and it looks like I would now give it an 80-20. They're going to make it. When we were talking about China, I said for the next 5 years, probably not that big a chance that they're totally going to fail, and the chances are about the same now. So things have gotten a lot better over the last year. It's just there's not a lot of reporting. There's not a lot of reporting on the getting a lot better.
And why do I bring this up? Why is it important here at the end of the year to take a look around? And rather than looking at the threats and the risks, look at the fact that the threats and the risks that we have seen over the last several years that still weigh on us and as a result, still have an effect on market values, didn't materialize. Are they completely eliminated? No. But they didn't materialize as the disaster that was forecast. And I want you to think about just a moment that you combine the fact that the threats, one after another, have been eliminated with the fact that the economic indicators, let me give you a little example of an economic indicator. The purchases of electronics in dollar terms in the United States in November was up 10% over last year. Now, when I say that okay, 10% rise, big deal. No, 1 month, November versus the previous November, we're leading into Christmas. People are starting to buy their Christmas presents. And if you go to an electronics store, or more likely you go to Amazon and look at the price of a given piece of electronics,
it's
versus
cheaper.
Last year, it's a lot less expensive. So we're buying more things.
A lot more things.
Now, you could say, well, consumerism is bad, or you could make a negative out of anything that you want to make a negative out of.
I tend to think that consumerism and capitalism is great.
We have momentum, which is what we were talking about on the way
it's
in.
It's a different
okay?
kind of, it's not physics momentum.
Well, I think the Higgs boson.
That's in different, you know, we're talking particle physics now. We're talking about quantum mechanics. That's a different kind of momentum.
Yeah, well, it has something to do with oil and dollars in this particular case.
This kind of momentum has to do with attitude.
Psychologically.
It's the psychological momentum of it's really hard when you got a big group of people feeling a certain way. It's really hard to dampen it without a lot of change. It takes a lot of energy to dampen that mood, whether it's a good mood or a bad mood. And we were coming out of a really bad mood.
Well,
it's been gradual. But the momentum shift into a good mood is pretty
big. For
whatever
it's worth, historically, the third year of a second term of the president is normally a great market year, which it wasn't this year.
Right.
Normally, the fourth year of the second term of a president stinks.
And I wouldn't be surprised to see a lot of volatility this year just because there's not an incumbent. There's going to be a lot of bad news. Both the Democrats and the Republicans are going to talk about all the broken things. That's what their job is right now, because you're not going to vote for them unless they can tell you how they're going to fix everything.
But
so they have to tell you where everything's broken.
This is where I think we may see some things happening that'll be a bit of a surprise. I really continue to be optimistic about 2016. And the for starters, the leading economic indicators, the indicators from the current economic indicators leading into 2016, all are indicating increased economic health in the United States. We are seeing very clear evidence that the big threats to the European economy are dissipating. Nobody knows what's going on in China except that whatever it is, it isn't causing great disruptions yet.
Yet.
We can always say we don't know, so it must be bad. Or we can say, well, they've survived everything else so far, and they seem to be doing okay.
We don't know, so we don't know. I mean, it's really easy to fret about the things you don't know. There's a lot of them out there. Most of the universe is unknown. And we can worry about it, or we can move about our lives and prepare for the things that we're capable of preparing for. And I think that's the big thing. If you are investing right now, be well diversified. Make sure that you've made good decisions on where you are, and then ride it. Be well diversified is the first thing there, though. So the people that are jumping into this hot stock or that hot stock, well, it's going to be a bumpy ride. It might be a great ride. It might be a horrible ride.
You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. We'd love to have some calls with some questions, comments, thoughts, or something like that. 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And again, the good news is, we should be giving thanks at this point in the year. 2015, for all its warts and pimples, is a year during which the United States economy, of the large economies, not like Luxembourg, actually grew faster than the United States this year, but of the large economies on the planet, the United States demonstrated the greatest health. The Chinese economy technically is growing faster than the United States, and I want to emphasize the technically, but you got to take into account the fact that a very large portion of the food in China is still produced in fields where oxen are pulling plows, which, by the way, 2,000 years ago is the way things were going on at Christmas in Western civilization. So they've got a long ways to go to grow to a point where they are actually up to the level that we are. And frankly, the demographics indicate they probably won't get there. Sure, we've got some problems, and we've always got problems. You can always find problems. But right now, every one of our problems that I was able to identify looking for serious problems in the United States has to do with the fact that we're not growing as fast as we'd like to. And I want you to think about the nature of that problem. It's not that we're shrinking. It's not that we're declining. It's just we're not growing quite as fast as we'd like to. And a lot of people make a lot of money off of scaring other people and making them believe that something bad is happening or is going to happen and causing people to be fearful. The secret in investing is to get ahead of that, to recognize it is when people are fearful, which is now, that it is a good time to be invested and it's a good time to invest. And be sort of like Warren Buffett, and you buy and hold for a really long period of time. And, you know, we can talk about that, but I'm monopolizing the airtime.
This is a total change of subject, but Verizon and Sprint are coming up on a deadline where they're going to need to refund a bunch of money to a bunch of people. And bunch is the technical word here. On cramming. Cramming is, if you've ever looked at your landline phone bill and seen long-distance carrier charges, not because you made long-distance call, but because they are charging money so that if you ever do make a long-distance call, it will be on this other weird third-party's lines. Most people had never even heard of the company before. Somehow they got roped into the deal, and what happened is that the major telephone companies didn't have good systems in place to make sure that the customer actually requested the shift. That's called cramming. It just showed up on the bill, and if you don't pay it, then you get collections notices and all kinds of other things. Well, there have been a series of lawsuits against the major phone companies for authorizing payments to people that the customer never authorized payments to, and the deadline's coming up, so some money's going to be coming back into the pockets of people that got scammed, basically. It's not even a scam. It's just suddenly you got charged more money and you had to pay it. It's the companies got scammed and they were charging the customers, which is not cool. And that goes kind of back into that concept of if expenses go up for a company, they pass it on to the consumer. But if the consumer is being charged for the company's faults and the company isn't doing anything about it, there should be repercussions. We've got some commercials to play.
Oh, yes. We probably ought to do that. And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake.
I'm sorry about that. I didn't realize you were drinking. With Jeff and Jake McClure. And the telephone numbers in here will remain as they are, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
You got to admit that the timing was just about
very
perfect.
Nice. Thank you.
And we will be back after these important words from KTM sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I just had a question about Turkey and, I guess, the recent information that's come to light about them. Basically, I wouldn't say helping ISIS, but being rather feckless about stopping them coming into their country and resupplying and taking their oil. And also, I think it was this week, they just had some military coordination, whether or not that was from the government or some, you know, individual doing that. What do you think we as NATO are going to do about these recent revelations? I'll hang up and take my answer off.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Turkey lately has been, in essence, doing the same kind of invasion of Syria that Russia did of Ukraine, which is to say Turkey says we're not there, but there's a lot of Turkmen there that generally would wear the uniform of the Turkish military if they had their patches on. They moved into northern Syria, and if you look at the map of Syria, Kobane was... It's a border town, and ISIS was right up against the border with Turkey, and Turkey didn't like that. So they invaded while not invading, no official troops, but they invaded. There's a big Turkmen presence in northern Syria, and Kobane is no longer in the hands of either the Kurdish or the of ISIS because the Turks are holding it. Now, they didn't like having the Syrian Kurds there because Syrian Kurds have been a rebel group in Turkey for a long time.
Well,
so throw that all together with the Turkmen there were funding their efforts by buying oil, and some of it probably was purchased indirectly from ISIS, but probably not on purpose because they're more enemies of ISIS than we are. They really don't want ISIS to spread.
There's a fundamental issue in that part of the world, and it is extremely fundamental. And without understanding this thing I'm about to talk about, you really can't even begin to grasp what's going on there. And that is that the lines we call Syria or the border of Turkey, all of these things are straight lines that were drawn through what at the time was a more or less desert wilderness area by two men. I don't remember their names now, but they were, one was a French diplomat and the other one was a British diplomat, following World War I, because the Ottoman Empire had collapsed. And the Ottoman Empire's collapse was associated with World War I, and the British and the French basically divided the old Ottoman Empire at the end of World War I between them, and they just, where there were convenient areas, they drew lines on a piece of paper and said, here's the border. And then they installed rulers. I mean, the reason Saudi Arabia is Saudi Arabia is the Saud family was really friendly with the British, and they had cooperated with the British in World War I, the tribe that was the Saud family. And they basically gave them a big chunk of terrain and said, be nice to us. And the Anglo-American Oil Company was formed so we could get oil out of there. If you go back and read these histories, what we call Turkey today used to be the Ottoman Empire. And the borders are extremely arbitrary. And Jake was talking about Turkmen. Turkmen is a tribe of people who speak the same language as the Turks. And it's kind of like World War One and Two was largely about Germany annexing the territory where the people spoke German. And they were traditionally think of themselves as German. Only they called it Deutsch, and we've never...
Right, the same thing when Ukraine, when the Russians came in and said they speak Russian. Anyway, we don't like it because we like the concept of a firm boundary that doesn't move with the whim of people. But if a boundary was set up by the whim of people, then we're talking about whims anyway.
So you've got this... It's really hard to define who is selling oil to whom there, and generally the people who are involved don't know because there's middlemen involved too.
Lots of middlemen. That's another piece to understand here. A lot of people.
That's another tribe, the middlemen.
Right. A lot of people have oil trucks because it's a big business there, and just like trucking here, it's not owned by one company. The majority of trucks in that area are independently owned. So if a trucker goes and buys from ISIS and then turns around and goes to sell to Turkey.
Well, he doesn't even necessarily know he's buying from ISIS. No. He's just buying from somebody who's got oil.
Right. That person has oil and they're not going to take it east. They're going to take theirs north. You want to buy some here. That's how the black market works. It isn't ISIS coming in with a big flag and saying, hey, Turkey, we're going to sell you oil. It is confusing enough that
And to
try to follow a normal legal set of purchases without having people in the middle of them destroying receipts or not taking receipts to begin with.
And they don't have much control over much of their border, by the way.
It's certainly not a computerized transaction of we're buying oil right here. And when we think of buying oil on a contract, it is absolutely not that way in Syria. There are people with buckets that sell oil on the side of the road in Syria.
Okay, we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
I recently bought a stock trader's almanac and was reading through that thing. It's kind of interesting. And I had two questions. One of them was, what is y'all's take on the information in that almanac? And the second question is, are there MACD indicators for stock indices like Dow, S&P, as opposed to individual stocks?
Oh, sure. For instance, if you wanted to use the S&P 500, the symbol you look for is SPX. But do they mean anything? No. There are lots and lots and lots of people who attempt to time the market. And I mentioned, I think, last hour that Warren Buffett said something that was so very, very accurate. He said that stock market timers, timing the market using any of those methods is just a really, really good way to turn a large fortune into a small fortune.
There are some things that are predictable. The weather is predictable to some extent. The mass movements of weather is really predictive, and the seasons change. Almanacs over the years have gotten a great deal of trust placed into them, not we're talking about farmers' almanacs now, where the predictions on weather, at least in a broad sense, are very, very accurate. The stock market doesn't work on weather the same way. There are tendencies. Sometimes it's more up in October. Sometimes it's more down in October. Sometimes when one team wins the World Series, the market changes. Sometimes when the NFL is the World Cup or whatever you do. I'm throwing these words together because they have no mystic meaning in the stock market. If you have a tidal influence on weather, that's real. If you have a
the fact that the Pacific Ocean in certain areas is warmer or cooler will affect the weather patterns in the United States. We know that. By the way, we don't know why it gets warmer or cooler. In the market, it's more like quantum mechanics. The act of observation changes the thing observed. If you find something that works, it's an anomaly in the market and it's published, it normally ceases. Not only does it cease to work, it reverses itself. So after it's published, if you find something that is a surefire way to make money that somebody publishes, by doing it, you increase the probability of losing money.
To me, it's very similar to going to Vegas and looking at the roulette wheel. And next to the roulette wheel will have a whole bunch of numbers that have just won. Listing those numbers has absolutely zero chance of changing the next number that wins. And yet the folks at Vegas have found that if they post those numbers and a number appears more than once on that list, so a number got hit multiple times recently, people put a lot more money on that number. And it's just a way of getting people to bet more. In this case, it's a way of getting people to pay a monthly subscription to get more up-to-date information on what's trending right now. That's not to say that seasonal indicators don't have an impact. It doesn't say that there's no good whatsoever to come out of this, because there's some educational material out of the Stock Traders Almanac that's really pretty valuable. Mm-hmm. It's the predictions that are scary.
So like I said, for the MACD, which is kind of an indicator on if the market is going to now start trending up or going down, which...
Well, it may be an indicator, but it may not be an indicator.
So if you say, have a balance, you know, you have a certain strategic balance in your portfolio, and you're going to rebalance, you know, at a certain time through the year or twice a year or whatever, and you look at that type of an indicator to say, well, I'm going to balance at this time.
Well, let me...
Again, just...
Let me simply say that, how much did that book cost you?
I don't know, $30.
Okay. Do you really think that a $30 book in a fair market would provide you information that could make you tens of thousands of dollars? Answer
well,
is
no. I bought it for just, you know, I've been investing for a long time and just bought it for a little more insight and this stuff. And
mm-hmm. It is.
Let me address that real quick. The MACD, it's a good one to start with. That's a chart most people listening haven't ever heard of MACD besides a place that you go to get hamburgers and french fries.
That's Mickey D's. That's
right.
Different,
it's
right.
It's a different thing. MACD is the moving average convergence and divergence chart. It's when you have a long-term average for something happening in the stock market, and you have multiple averages, and when they converge and diverge, and it's basically different time scales on the averages. It's a good way in a steady state economy of indicating what's going on. We don't have a steady state economy. And when I say that, if you have a long-term moving average and you say this is the trend, so we can hypothesize that it's going to continue and go on into the future, that works on some things. It works on weather. It works on a lot of things. And sometimes works with humans, and that's what the stock market is humans. But I had a book that was written in the 1970s, one of the books that I had as a child. It was a book on statistics and trivia. And one of the things that it said was, at the current rate of training, the whole world will be Elvis impersonators for a living by 1987. Some trends don't continue, and understanding that, what is the top of the trend? People win Nobel Prizes on that to try to figure out, when is it that the mood shifts so that this trend is no longer an indicator, and when does it become an indicator again? Those aren't things that are easily understood. You can look at an indicator, and it will be absolutely right until it isn't.
There is a method that you can read about that, if you care to follow it, historically has produced superior returns. And it's basically figuring, and it's exemplified by the way Warren Buffett invests. Fundamentally, you look at a part of the economy that is necessary for the economy, that is limited supply and is unlikely to be easy to expand. And one of the things, for example, a few years ago, he determined the cost of fuel was up. A lot of other things were working against it. And as a result, railroad stocks were across the board down. Very, very low. Railroads were going out of business. And he looked at how hard it was to put in a new rail line, like nearly impossible. Getting the eminent domain that they got to put in the rail lines to begin with was nearly impossible. He looked at the fact that over the long term, it's cheaper to move money. It's cheaper to move goods across the country by railroad than it is by truck. And he looked at the fact that he could buy, and he looked at so the probable future earnings of Burlington Northern Railroad, for example. And he determined that the present value of those probable future earnings was a lot higher than what the stock was selling for, so he bought the company. Now, did he have an advantage over the rest of us? Yes, we typically, if you're very, very efficient and you're using a firm like ours, which is a fee-only investment advisory firm, to do your research and you do all this stuff, or you do it yourself, you can buy, you might wind up spending 1.5% or 2% as your cost, your transactional cost of owning something. And so you got to make a profit above that. Now, he can get that down to about 0.25%. So he's got an advantage over the rest of us. How does he do that? He doesn't go through managers or anything. He just buys the whole company.
Yeah. And then he
uses somebody else's money to buy the whole company.
Then he installs his own staff to help manage the company, right, which are really, really good at managing companies.
And in many cases, he lets the companies run. The previous investors had suppressed them. But the point is that if you do that kind of fundamental research and you buy companies that are trading below their appropriate present value, you have to have a lot of data. You have to do a lot of work to do that. And then the key element that most people are missing. People will actually help you do that work. They'll provide you with letters and so on. The key is sometimes when you buy a good value investment and you pay less for it than it's worth, it may take the market years and even a decade or longer to recognize that what you did was brilliant.
Now, the moving average trades, the making trades on technical information, holds the ability to make a lot of money in a short period of time. It also holds the ability to lose a lot of money in the short period of time. And if you're looking at it short-term, long-term, you don't – in the short-term trading, you're measuring every decision you make about if you made profit or loss over the next 2 days. You're going to have a lot of failures in there. It's going to happen, and it's going to wear on you.
I have, over the years, both known – and professionally followed, because they were using us as a broker when I was a broker, people who studied the MACD and the MACV and every other kind of moving average you'd want to imagine. I had a guy who had a room that he had 6 or 8 computers in. He followed all of this and he traded off of it to try to get the timing of his trades exactly right. And over the years, a simple buy and hold of his original investment, which wasn't particularly good. It was just an average, mediocre mutual fund, as a matter of fact, would have done a heck of a lot better than he did through all his very carefully timed trades.
But he felt good about himself doing it, terrified of it at the end.
Actually, he became very depressed at the end because he'd lost so much money.
We have another call.
But it was sort of an entertainment thing. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning, Jake and Jeff.
Good morning.
Ooh, I hear a flying fox.
This is a famous flying fox.
We only have about 1 minute.
All right, real quick. Happy birthday, happy new year, Merry Christmas and all that.
Well, thank you.
One comment to add. With the subject you're talking on, several years ago I bought a book written by a fellow by the name of Tobias.
Oh, yes.
You probably know him. I read that book, and the single important thing I got was that that trading in the stock market is not an avocation, it is a vocation. If you can't spend full time and full effort, then you better not fool with it.
That's what I say about flying.
I took his advice, and I signed up with Jeff and Jake, and never been sorry of it. Happy New Year, you guys.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. We didn't pay him to say that.
No, we didn't. Let me tell you the advantage of the gentleman who was just on there. I wish I could tell you that I had done everything brilliant in his portfolio over those years. I can't. There's things I would have done different. But I can also tell you that the greatest making diversification, which we did right, that's number one. Number two, time and patience. The United States economy is healthy and growing. It is reflected in the market. If you're broadly diversified and you stick around long enough, historically, you have done well. It's that simple. It's not exciting. It's boring. It's like a religion. It requires faith. But you've been listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. We're out of time. Local number if you want to contact us, 947-1111.
TEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood. The best talk in America. News Radio 1400.